My name's Bob P. I'm a codependent. And my story is, I'm 82 years of age, so it's a long, I don't want to make it real long, but it's a story encompassing 82 years. Yes. Oh, sorry. So I was born in Detroit in 1926, Detroit, Michigan, the east side of Detroit, and my dad was a sort of a heavy-handed German. He ran had his own little company called the Plath Engineering Company. And my mother was one of the most scared women I've ever known. I loved her dearly, but she was just terrified. Her father had never let her even sit on his lap because they got married to my mother's mother. And he had had a child by a previous marriage, and my mother's mother didn't treat little Gertie correctly, so he kind of took it out on my mother when she was born and totally kind of cut her off. So there was a first example of unforgiveness that was just had horrible consequences, because my mother was always kind of terrified and always kind of looking to somehow, you know, somebody to take care of her. And since I was the firstborn, I was kind of the one, you know, that was something that affected me. But I was brought up on the east side in Detroit, as I said, and out in the backyard, one of the first things I remember was that the little guys from the neighborhood got together with me. They were older, a little older. I was about two or three. And they said, you see those guys over there? I said, yeah. Well, those are the bad guys, and we're the good guys. And we throw tin cans at them, and we throw mud balls with apples in them. I said, we do? Okay. You know? So what was interesting to me, thinking back on it, was that I was being taught to be a warrior. I was being taught, even at that young age, to not show feelings and to feel that these other guys were bad guys. And one day when I was running around, in this little kind of between gangs, I was the slowest one. I got grabbed by the other gang, and they said, "Hey, little guy," and they were perfectly fine. They were kind of didn't know what to do, and so I mean, I didn't get the feeling that they were these bad guys. They were just like me or everybody else, and there were so many things being taught in the neighborhood that were just junk. Partly, women are sissies. Women can't drive. Women are weak. Women are... And I'm getting all this stuff, and I'm buying into it, because I've got two younger sisters, one of which I kind of resented when she was born. I felt some love was taken from me. And I was taught something that I totally disbelieve today, because now, in all honesty and total truth, I see the beauty of women like I've never seen before, and their power. And, I feel like when I deal like with forgiveness, I've now, out of all the things that's occurred to me, set up a worldwide forgiveness alliance, and I'm trying to get an International Forgiveness Day out across the world. We just celebrated our 12th celebration last year. But the people that sometimes seem to have the most up-level reactions and strength and power were women. Our last International Forgiveness Day last August, we had four incredible women as our heroes of forgiveness. I tried to set up, because I had seen this war model and the way we were being taught to be warriors, I thought that we should have heroes of forgiveness, reconciliation, and peace. So that's what we've honored. We've honored about 40 people in the last 12 years that have been incredible in that respect. But going back, when I went out in the neighborhood also, one day I watched Judy Pandel from our little gang fight Bobby Crawford from the other little gang. And Bobby killed Junie. And he was laying in the dust groveling, but he could not show feelings. He could not show feelings. because that would be a sign of some kind of weakness. So it was only when the other gang walked away that Junie could start this torrent of tears and kind of let down. And so I was being taught another thing: don't show feelings. And I think that that is catastrophic, because I think that when little boys can't show feelings, they build up a lot of anger, and a lot of that stuff comes out on everybody, including women. Our organization, now we go in as part of our process, we go into the RIN services for women, and we deal with chemically dependent women, women who've been terribly abused and have been, and are used drugs and alcohol. And the forgiveness is absolutely critical for them, because to the degree that they can forgive, they break loose of the need to drink. Because I see, like, as Bill sees it, one thing I was just going to point out. It says, dealing with resentments. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we have also been spiritually ill. When our spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. In dealing with our resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people. Now, this is the fourth step that he's talking about. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We asked ourselves why we were angry. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. The most heated fit of letter writing can be a wonderful safety valve, providing the wastebasket is somewhere nearby. And in your handout, at around the back pages, is a what I call a love letter. If anybody doesn't have a handout, they're right up here. And in that, if you, in like doing a step four, or step, I particularly mentioned step four today because it so applies to forgiveness. In fact, I feel that steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11 are really all steps of forgiveness and release and letting go. So if ever with that so-called love letter, you don't have to send it to anybody, but it does release a lot of resentments, and you can get out your resentments safely, and you can also deal with your fear and your... you can deal with also the forgiveness aspects, and you can deal with being pardoned. I'm missing on that one point. Oh, hurt and sadness. So you deal with anger and blame, hurt and sadness, fear and insecurity, and also then take guilt and responsibility. Because almost invariably, we play a part in what took place. I'm sorry that I forgive you for what you've done. Please forgive me for what I've done. And then you get down to the love and to the forgiveness, understanding, and what you want. So going back to my own history, when I was, as I say, I saw it right then and there, I had to suppress feelings, everything that was built. And I first even went in the backyard and out and in the alley in Detroit and played baseball. Everything was built on winning. If you didn't get a hit, you were out. And they were, I got to the point that I wanted to win at almost all costs. And it was stupid. And it was taking me away from being myself. And I also got to the point that meant I had to control and, but in the meantime, I was dealing with my father and my mother. And as I said, my father was kind of a heavy-handed German. And he was running his own company, and we eventually moved from Detroit out to Grosse Pointe, which was a well-to-do suburb. And it seemed like everything was going great. I had a beautiful home and in a really nice neighborhood and so forth. But in the meantime, my dad was smoking, drinking, and eating very lousy foods in terms of a lot of fat, because they didn't realize that that would possibly block an artery or so on. And one day in 1939, just before World War II started, as I came home, it was right near Christmas, my little sister Mary, 2 years younger, came out and she said, Bobby, Daddy's dead. And the first thoughts I had were Freudian. They were good. I'll be boss. I'll have mother. I'll have the car. And I had wished my father dead sometimes when he would hit me. And it was almost like all this was realized. I had no idea of what death meant. I had no idea that these were childish thoughts. We had moved from one parish to another, so we had lost contact with anything to do with the clergy. And nobody that I could talk to, so I felt I then made certain determinations. One, don't you punish me, God. I'll punish me. But, you know, I won't have, because I want to take over my dad's dead body. I won't have. These are core beliefs that I was starting to set up. And then my mother's so terrified, and she's kept saying, you're going to be the man of the family. I'm 13. All the guys that were part of my dad's company took the accounts and left, which meant, what am I going to do? I'm 13, you know, like I felt like this little kid that was helpless. And then came a kind of a core belief, I'm not enough. I'm not enough. This is too much. And my mother was saying, I would go out to the playground and avoid kind of life in that respect. And I, in the meantime, wanted to be the boss. And I had no concept of what being a boss meant. And I was guilt-ridden, so I'm projecting that on everybody else, and I'm a total idiot, and very difficult to live with, and I'm trying to push my sister around, everybody, to be the boss. And my sister was 2 years younger, but she was far wiser than I was, and she was tired of being bullied, which I had done over the years. I do not sound like at that point that I was a very nice person. I wasn't. But I was doing the best I could to survive, you know, under the circumstances. So she sort of said, I'm not going to go along with your dictates. She had a lot of courage, and she was right. And I just couldn't take it. So as a part of a control situation, I stopped speaking to her in my own house for almost 4 years to try to enforce my rule, which was just total idiocy. And I look back on that as Mary and I are close today and we've totally forgiven, but I still feel that was something, the family, I got the realization that a family that loses a father or a mother is very dysfunctional, has tremendous impacts for your lifetime. Because I went from being a kid that was being rather sure of himself and, you know, getting along with the girls in the neighborhood and doing well in sports and feeling very confident, I went now to the point that I had no confidence. I was a sort of ashamed to be seen. And I was running, like, out to the ball field instead of, you know, just really being taking up the load, taking responsibility, and, you know, doing things right. So I had a long history then of dysfunction and of guilt and of shame and of just terrible things and being a control freak. So, and not knowing, because I was saying, I don't deserve, I was also, as I got to be 18 and 19 and 20, when I went in the service, I was really a front. I mean, I was a man on the surface, but underneath, a little kid that was scared and not sure of himself. So from that came a lot of abuse of myself. And when I was 18, I was in the service. 1944, World War II was still going on. I now joined the Navy, and I'm sent, and it's still in the United States, and I'm wearing a uniform, but I'm really out of it. I've suppressed all, like, sort of sexual and so on. Until I was 18, I had one night at a bar about three shots of whiskey, and that set me off to be open. Boy, all of a sudden I felt like I was released from all of these, the shame feelings and so on. And I started, that was a way of me, for the first time, having sex with just being held and kissed. And I was like a tornado breaking out or breaking loose, because I had all these repressed and pent up feelings. So with that, I started drinking. And I was great for a while. For about the first hour, I was quite, you know, ingenious and laughing and joking and everything great. And then I turned into this idiot. I mean, I became angry. A lot of the stuff that was going on down below, repressed, was now coming out. And it was not nice to deal with. So that when I deal with something like making amends on step one of the steps, I have a lot to work with, because also I had put up walls against my sister and my mother, and that those walls blocked me with all women. And I say that because I believe that the 12 steps are so critical, and I'm working now myself. I'm just working on the concept of this step four, which is to take a fearless moral inventory. And so this is almost like a step five to me. I'm sort of just in a, not in the in the totality of it, but I'm saying sort of like what I have to make amends for. And I had a great amount of wonderful women that I was involved with, and, you know, but every time it was that I had this wall up, and no matter what I did, I couldn't get out from under it. And I can't pretend that even today, as I stand here at 82, I don't have some great love relationship going on with me, which in some ways, as I say that to you, I feel ashamed. And but I do believe, like I've been reading in preparation for this talk, I've been reading Melody Beattie. I don't know if anybody's ever read her. I see that you have. And she just points out that as you get in, you don't have to, with the steps, you don't have to so much work and work and work, although I think it takes courage to go into the fourth step and have the courage to really get in and do it. Because she points out that again and again we can avoid the fourth step because it opens up pain. But I believe without pain, there is no gain. That if you don't deal with the fourth step, if you don't deal with that fearless moral inventory, you're going to be dealing with that pain on another level, and it's going to continue to run your life. So I heartily state that if that's something you haven't done, to be aware of it, to let to have it happen, because it's a way to get to forgiveness. And when you tell on the fifth step to somebody that you trust about what you've done that has been wrong, by doing that, you break, every time you mention in any type of situation where you did harm to yourself or to others, or they did harm to you and so on, every time you open up and use like the love letter or express yourself in that respect or sit down and do the fourth step, every time you do it, you are really doing forgiveness. Because by the very opening it up, by the very release of the charge on it, by the very fact that you have the courage to go in and really take this on for your own benefit, because it's going to help you extraordinarily. By doing that, you begin this process of forgiveness. And every time you forgive, there is a, like a fixed attention mass in your mind that is, you know, where the unforgiveness lies. And as you release that, as you let go, because forgiveness is letting go, you don't just do it. You don't pretend forgiveness. You can be a phony then. But use a love letter to get out your anger, your sadness, and like Bill said in that thing, you put it down on paper and then get it over to the nearest wastebasket. Don't continue to hang on to it. That's my advice. I think it's very difficult sometimes. Like with myself, I did so many things that were a blocking relationship with women that I have a lot of amends that I'm not even totally aware of. But I think that if you set the process in motion, if you have the little willingness, A Course in Miracles says have a little willingness, just a little willingness to forgive, no matter how much you've been hurt, no matter how deep it's been, if you have that little willingness, God comes in and starts presenting you with all kinds of opportunities to forgive. And it's remarkable. A book will appear in your life, or a person will appear, or Coda will appear and say, "Do you want to make a speech, Bob? Bob T?" And all of a sudden, you're in the middle of, without doing anything, God just being in charge, you're getting forgiveness and you're getting an opportunity to get free. And what is the freedom? The freedom is to take better care of yourself, the freedom to love yourself more, the freedom to let others love you, the freedom to become intimate, because I know I'm still scared of intimacy. The freedom to let go of control more than you have. And just, it gradually happens, or it happens in a thunderclap, you know? One of the women that we had as our hero of forgiveness last August, just in August, her husband had her take in to be, wait for him, a paranoid schizophrenic woman who she allowed in her house and so on, and all of a sudden this woman got a knife and had some kind of a crazy thing that she was going to be told to kill this woman, Julie Chimes. And when Julie was first, she was stabbed by this woman, and when her first feelings were sort of like this was part of a pattern, and that she felt a love for the woman almost immediately. That is very unusual, because we all remember, look at ourselves, it sometimes takes years to open up to people who have harmed us, or we don't even have to reconcile, you know, we just have to free ourselves. One of the women that we honored was Eva Kaur, Jewish. Eva is about 75 years of age. She was at Auschwitz when the Nazi doctor, a guy named Mengele, this weird man, her and her twin sister were put on a platform with her family. And that platform was one of the bloodiest platforms in history, because at that point, they would separate those that were going to the gas chamber and those that were going to live. Mengele selected Eva and her sister because they were twins and he could do these experiments on them. He never saw them as human beings. He saw them as experiments. And that eventually led to her sister dying with kidney failure. But Eva lived. She lived even though Mengele had given her some injections that she'll only last 2 weeks. Eva would crawl the length of that dormitory to get a drink of water and come back, and she was determined to live. And she did live. She lived, and then she eventually escaped or was released from Auschwitz. And years later, she decided that she wanted to forgive. She realized she had an incredible power. And the way she put it, I had the power to forgive, to free myself. I wasn't doing it for anybody else. I was doing it for me. So forgiveness is not, you're not trying to save somebody else, or you're not going to let the dirty bastard off the hook or whatever. You know, you're doing it for you. You're doing it for you. You're not doing it for them. Like I said to Eva on the phone, I said, what about Adolf, Eva? And she says, it's forgiveness is for me. I forgave Mengele, I forgave Hitler, I forgave all the Nazis because I wanted to be free. And forgiveness is a totally free medicine, and it works. In the handout, right off the bat, of the first page of the handout, benefits of forgiveness. Reduction in physical symptoms of stress. We found, the experiments have shown, that heart attacks come from anger, where you build up all this pressure and adrenaline and all kinds of substances in your blood, and cancer, and you can have all kinds of diseases because we're so connected, mind-body, that if we don't handle these different things that sort of have been presented to us and heal them, and forgiveness is, Jim Pulsky says, forgiveness is the greatest healer of them all. And if I sound a little like I'm sold on forgiveness, please forgive me because I am. Because it saved me, because I was brought up in a hellfire and damnation religion. And when that thing happened with my father, wishing him dead, I felt like I was going to go to hell. And I sort of said to God, don't you punish me, I'll punish me. And now I totally see, like with the 12 steps, God is a very wonderful, loving, always in, you know, trying to do the very best for us, even against our own, you know, foibles. And so I feel that I'm lost. I forgot what I was saying. But I feel that the benefits are fantastic, and, you know, we're trying to do what we can to bring some of these ideas and so on into the health service across the country and so on, because we've also seeing that, therefore, you know, you can prevent these diseases and so forth, and you can stop them in your own body if you have the willingness to really release and let go and use these processes, which I think are very excellent. So, with respect to my own history, I have had, I somewhere along the line began to feel that forgiveness. I went to Hastings Law School because being a lawyer, you're in control. You know, I mean, you can cross-examine, you got the courts, you got all this and that, and I want to win arguments. I wanted to be the top dog and the most controlling person. And in my class were some other, Willie Brown was my classmate, and I had, you know, like it was a good class, but I was became the student body president, and I was the first independent student body president ever elected at Hastings since, 1850 or something like that. But I was doing it for the wrong reasons. I wanted to be loved. I was doing all these different things, sort of like, please love me. I can't love me, so please, can I get love? Can I do this? Can I get attention? You know, all the wrong reasons. And at that time, I broke up from a relationship I had with a girl from Mills College. And I started living down in the Tenderloin, this little flea trap hotel, and at $7 a week, with, you know, stained yellow curtains and black shade on the window. it was my punishment of myself, and it was sort of the way I saw myself. And God worked a strange gift to me at that point, because I had passed the bar the first time by, I don't know, I just had the ability to pass the test. And I was hiding out from doing anything with the law. And all of a sudden, one night, the higher power kind of came in, and all of a sudden I got a knock on the door. And there, I opened the door, there's this little bird-like woman, and her name was Olive Crum. I mean, she was just broken down, and she was going to lose her little daughter because she hadn't been able to take care of her right. So I thought, oh my God, I got to help this lady, even though I'm drinking during the day, and I mean, I'm running around exercising during the day and drinking at night. I was well on my way to be an alcoholic. But what could I do? Here's Olive Crum. And I decided, yeah, I'll try to help you, Olive. You know, and again, I was doing it pro bono. So I ended up with, on that Friday, with her husband had come all the way down from Seattle to, with the new wife, to take Olive back. But he hadn't been there for several years, and that's when Olive had been falling apart. And she was, you know, her room was a mess, and the little girl was kind of living in that, and Olive was drinking, and so on. And I did my best. I argued that the husband, had caused a lot of the problem, because he'd never been there for Olive or for Lila. And now he comes and wants everything for himself. Well, the judge was ready to give what I wanted, which was to send Lila to a foster home for 6 months while Olive got herself together. Then the foster home lady stands up in the courtroom and says, Judge, we have no openings. We have nothing. We can't do anything. So the judge takes Lila. We get a new dress on, and Lila was almost like taking care of her mother. Takes her in the chambers, talks to her, would you be willing to go with your dad for a while? And Lila said, yeah, because she kind of would like to be with her dad too. And so I went downstairs and to the, after this was over, and they took Lila and going to give her to the husband. We went down to the restaurant down below in the building, and I said, now we could all work together like a family, I said to the man. He says, I'm never going to let this woman ever get this girl again. I'm going to cut her off. She's rotten. I don't want anything to do with her. That's great for Lila, right? I mean, she's been with her mother and everything, and all of a sudden he's setting it up so that when he goes back to Seattle, he gets the custody changed and so on. This is another illustration of the terrible things that unforgiveness can do. And about a few years later, I get a call from Lila. Do you know where my mother is? Do you know where my mother is? And, geez, what can I say? I last seen Olive going down the, like around 4th Street with a little Siamese cat on a leash, and you know, partly terribly distraught or distressed, and maybe somewhat relieved that Lila was gone. So I mention that because as a lawyer, I have gone through all kinds of situations of trying to control or sometimes not being able to set fees correctly, not valuing myself enough, having a hard time sometimes nurturing myself, or really, being a caretaker of me, of loving myself, of feeling that I deserve, that every one of us here, I feel, is extremely valuable. We do come from the higher power, and all of us are the children of the higher power, so I think that is a sign to me that we are deserving of the very greatest, because we come from the greatest. And when I turn that, BT, Melody, when Melody, she talks about talking to God. And that was really kind of interesting to me. And, you know, and turning your things over to God again and again and again. And I feel like that's working for me. About a year ago, I was in setting up the Alliance, the International, the Worldwide Forgiveness Alliance, and trying to get an International Forgiveness Day across the world. That's a tough project. Forgiveness is sometimes brings up pain and hurt and so forth, and therefore there's a resistance to it. And yet there's an appeal. There's an appeal to the idea of an International Forgiveness Day, that for one day in the world, across the world, would be forgiveness thought about, and, you know, forgiveness of debts, forgiveness of our religions, forgiveness of between parties and families. And, you know, like right now, I've got a case this week where one brother is all irritated with another, and they get in this fight, and they end up with assault with a deadly weapon on one, and the other guy's got, you know, two broken ribs, and so on. And that's what the kind of legal work now that I do, which is more of that, of getting healing brought back in and stopping the divisiveness, and not a matter of who's going to beat the other, but a matter of how can we all win? How can we all win? So, with respect, I would like now, if anybody would have any questions or any thoughts that they have, or anything that they would like to bring forth to the group about forgiveness, I'm open to that. Yes.
Have you ever heard of a woman named Immaculee Elizabeth?
Yes. Yes, I have. I've talked to Immaculee. I tried to get her to Immaculee Ilabega. She's from Rwanda. And there they had these bloodbaths of the Tutsis and the Hutus. And her whole family was wiped out. And she, with about four or six other women, got into a kind of a little bathroom area that was blocked off from the house, and she could hear these guys, these crazy people that had been her friends. This is what's most remarkable. Sometimes, like in Rwanda, the Hutus were told to kill off the Tutsis, and even though they've all been friends for years in the same neighborhood, all of a sudden they got machetes and are wiping each other out. Immaculee was able to stay alive in that little bathroom area. She could hear these people coming around there saying, boy, I'd really like to knock off Immaculee. And she, in that period of time of 6 months, kept working and working with it until she came out totally forgiving and you know, is going across the country espousing the values of forgiveness. Sure. Yes?
Thank you for sharing about forgiveness. I think it's a very, very good topic to have, and one that I've come to appreciate. I've struggled with, I'm a recovering addict, and was in my addiction for almost 20 years. And the thing that I came to realize when I came into recovery was that not only did I have to work the first step and actually surrender to my addiction in order to begin to recover, I had to learn to forgive myself. Because until I could actually forgive myself for all the wreckage that I did and all the people that I had harmed, until I could actually do that, I could not begin my road to recovery. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I couldn't
begin to do that, because without forgiving myself, I was allowing myself to stay paralyzed.
Right.
You know,
right,
I had to release that. I had to be okay with what I did and with the people I had hurt and with and the wreckage I had caused within my life. I had to start that process within me.
Right.
And once I was able to do that and understand that, then that process started to begin, and to begin with, along with the surrendering and the making amends and so forth. And it had a lot to do with me having my 8 years clean and sober today. And I have tried the recovery throughout those 20 years many, many times. But that was the key.
Yeah.
It's not only admitting you're powerless, it's not only surrendering and making amends, you have to forgive yourself.
Right.
You really have to do that.
Right. Well, that's where I think that the... Yes. What? Sorry, I couldn't quite hear you.
I filed an EEOC case, Equal Employment Opportunity case.
Yeah.
It's my former employer, and I just really get stuck in all of that, and it's really hard for me to move on.
That's where I think forgiveness, love letter that's in the handout, I think that could be something that if you were to try to do one of those, with your anger, you know, that part of your the stuckness is because of feeling angry, right?
Yeah,
and resentful.
It's like a grieving process.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorrow, and it's just, the emotions get so high, I just don't feel.
Well, that's that process, that love letter, if you see in there, has got also a part for sorrow and grieving. So I would, and John Gray, that comes from John Gray, he wrote that book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. But I would just ask you to write one of those letters. You don't send a letter unless you've got some kind of relationship with the person that and that you've gotten taken away some of the anger and the bitterness. When I wrote those letters, I would just be, Christ, just get it all over the page. You know, just let it out. You've got to take that. You can't, as I say, you can't phony up forgiveness. You've got to get rid of that anger and so on and so forth, or else you're just pretending when you're dealing with the concept of forgiveness. You've got to get out those feelings. You've got to get the charge out. But one thing Fred Luskin says, he wrote the book Forgive for Good, or what Bill says, after a while, after you've written out that stuff and so on, get it to the wastebasket. What he means is don't get stuck in it. Don't get stuck in it, because then you're still the victim. You're playing out the victim. The biggest thing is if you can take where you've been victimized and you come to the point of being a hero of forgiveness, you've taken the like out of the mud grows the lotus, you know? I mean, it's all of the things that happened to me as a child, and everything that's occurred has created the possibility of an international forgiveness day through me, or the possibility of Worldwide Forgiveness Alliance really making a difference. But every one of you has that same ability to have, out of whatever has occurred to you, the gift that is your purpose, that is your power. And that is something to keep to being aware of, that every one of us, everything that's occurred to us, we can take it, and it's the raw material that we can use to take us up to higher dimensions. And a part of that is continuing to let God help us. Let God help us. I mean, because I had such a bad feeling about God after my father died. I hated the whole concept of a punishment, hellfire, damnation, and so on. I thought, how could that be that an all just God would create that you could go and be living forever in hell because you didn't make it to church on Sunday or something like that? It just didn't make sense. So now I have, when you deal with the 12 steps, you're dealing with a God that is very terrifically loving and wants, and if you're open to letting him help you, him, her, father, mother, helping you, gee, the sky's the limit, you know? But you've got to be willing. Yes?
I come from a family where
and the concept. Like we, in my family, we don't have forgiveness. It just doesn't exist because we're so preoccupied with justice, like this concept of justice. And like I noticed it because recently my mom was going through this depression, and I was too. And we had this pattern come up, and I looked at it, and she said, you know, I can't forgive myself because I have to take account for what I've done, and that kind of self-punishment thing before God can punish me thing. But the thing is that I think we do get confused about, like, what does God think about this, you know, and because I think in our family we equate forgiveness with acceptance of the behavior.
Right.
And so I think it's been a really confusing concept. Something I'm really glad you're bringing up because it makes me want to study it more. But there's definitely something there with the whole justice aspect, and I was wondering if you could speak about that a little bit.
Yes. Well, you know, we had one lady, we also know that it's like what Christ says, sort of like, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. It's sort of like you, you know, if it's like if somebody violates a law, they got to face that. That's, you know, they got to deal with that. And because the law may say that they're going to have to go to jail or be punished or along that lines. But, I mean, when you realize, when I was a little kid, even in the religion that I was brought up, I felt like Christ was something that was extraordinary. And like when he was on the cross, he said, forgive them, Lord, they know not what they do. Forgive them, Lord, they know not what they do. Eckhart Tolle, in the book, The Power of Now, and also Pursuit of, you know, your Vision, those two books, points out that,
justice.
Yeah, that he says, how can you not forgive when you realize that almost all people are coming from a certain amount of unconsciousness? I mean, you know, like they hate George Bush the concept that, you know, to hold them. But to me, the greatest justice of all is forgiveness, because I believe that that to the degree we can forgive, we make ourselves stronger, we become bigger, and we are more powerful. And we're more connected to the higher power because, in the big book, they say, if you have resentments, it takes you away from the sunshine of the spirit, is the way they put it. Away from the sunshine of the spirit. Well, hey, it is the sunshine. I mean, you know, let there be such. I mean, it's like incredible. Let the sun shine in. But to the degree that we hold these resentments, we keep ourselves locked in blockage and in unhappiness. So the question is, do you want to be right and make somebody wrong, or be happy? That's something that comes out of the Course in Miracles. Yes. Right.
So can you address that?
Yeah, yes. I think that to the degree that you can forgive, once you get the charge off, like the lady behind you there, she's talking about this thing that she's going on. It's an ongoing thing right now of her legal process. And that keeps bringing it up. But to the degree that you can forgive, you take the charge off of the anger, the resentment, and so on. To the degree you can take the charge off, you can have the memory, but it doesn't have a charge anymore. You don't. You're not stuck in it. You know, I can remember when I was this total idiot with my sister, not talking to her for 4 years, but I can deal with it now, and I can talk to Mary, and I will talk to Mary by tomorrow morning, and we're not. I can remember what occurred, but it doesn't. I have forgiven, and I've forgiven myself too, and that's what's incredible, because invariably it kind of works like a mirror. You can, to the degree you forgive outwardly, you're forgiving inwardly. To the degree you forgive inwardly, you're forgiving outwardly. It's all kind of like projection. But have I answered your question at all?
Yes.
So that if we, the real, we got to get not lost in this justice, because that means an eye for an eye, kind of like a tooth for a tooth, and a priest and a death, you know, life for a life. Pretty soon the guy says, you got a bunch of toothless, blind, lame people hanging around. But, no, yes, go ahead.
To me, forgiveness and acceptance sound very similar. And there's that famous paragraph in the A Big Book, that acceptance is the answer to all my problems today.
Right.
What to you is the difference between acceptance and forgiveness? Or how do they differ from each other?
Acceptance of, let me think about that. Well, forgiveness is a form of acceptance also, you know. But forgiveness it seems to me, goes, well, you accept whatever's taken place, and you accept it the way it is, but you may, forgiveness, though, I think, goes beyond that, because it takes in. I don't quite know. Let me just think about that for a moment.
Sure.
Okay.
I have a comment to say on that.
Yeah.
Possibly. It seems to me that the other way around, that acceptance, if you have acceptance of any people, place, or thing, you don't even have to go into the realm of forgiveness.
That's right.
Because if you accept.
If you accept, there's nothing to forgive.
Right, there you go. And that's why the Big Book says what you just said. Would you repeat that again?
No, acceptance is the answer to all my problems.
And that is the absolute truth, because keep in mind, in codependency, first of all, I don't accept myself, then I'm in trouble already.
Yeah.
I want to share a little story.
Sure.
A few years back, there was a lady at one of the schools that I worked at who I had heard and had known that she was very harsh and brash and, to be honest with you, hateful, okay? And but I didn't have to deal with her. But very, very close friends and dear friends of mine were under her. And I had to go to that school to do something. And she was somewhat involved, but the person that asked me to follow through with this function came to me and said, Linda, this. And I said, no problem, I will be there on the day you ask me to be there. Well, this harsh woman, she came to me to present this situation, which I already knew about. And my background head, who had already had made judgments about her, non-acceptance, said, not to worry, it's been dealt with. Well, you don't talk to this lady like that. You don't. I said, not to worry, it's been dealt with, thank you. You don't talk to her like that at all. She's the queen, she's the god, and you have to bow down to her. And I didn't by that comment. But she went and told the principal, she went crying, it was on Christmas, a big Christmas festivity was going on at the school, and she went crying to the principal and told him, I have ruined her entire Christmas. And someone called me and said, Linda, my gosh, do you know what just happened, blah, blah, blah. And I was like in shock. I said, I'm sitting in shock. And so within the next month, I was miserable. sleepless nights, blah, 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 on and on. You know, I had to go to that school site for various things. And so I go over there, you know, being in the program, I'd say, Lord, you know, I can't sleep. Obviously, I have to do something about this. And the Lord had said I have to go in there and make an amends. And, you know, I don't want to argue with him because I pretty much knew if I felt sick about it, there was something wrong that I had done. And so a couple of times I went over there and I get kind of scared, like maybe this is the time to do it and I really didn't want to. But finally, one day I went over there, a month later, a month of sleepless nights, a month of restlessness and hating myself on and on and on, way too long. Today's the day, he said. So I marched in there. No, I did not march in there. I humbly walked in there. I was very grateful that no one was present. So I walked in there and I said, I'm going to use her name as Mary. Poor Mary, they really get beat up. Is there any Marys in here? I said, Mary, I said, I was wrong with how I treated you the other day. And she went out and blasted me about how wrong I was, as loud as she could. Well, here comes all the secretaries accidentally passing by. They have to make copies of the copy machine all of a sudden, blah, 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 blah. And she's going on and on and on. And I'm looking at her, trying to have a calm look on my face, but really I'm in shock, but I'm a phony, and decided that I'm just going to just kind of be nice. And finally, after going online, she says to me, this must be really hard for you. Oh, and then she went on, I'm a Christian. She said, you're a Christian, and you know, I can't believe you did that. And so, you know, I looked at her, and she said, finally, she calmed herself down and said, this must be very hard for you. And I said, harder for me to face God.
Hard what?
Harder for me to face God and not make this right. And she said, well, thank you for coming in. And I said, thank you for accepting my words. Now, she did not forgive me at that moment. I'm sure she didn't. But I walked out and I said, I am going to go back in there and get that fat pig, grab her hair, slap her against the wall. I am about to kill her. She has humiliated me. I'm going to go right back and God said, and you will make amends again. So that day I left there feeling sick for about 2 more weeks. I'll be honest with you. You know, I'm not going to pansy this and tell you I felt heavenly, like I was just glowing on my way to heaven that moment. I left there feeling sick and really wanted to tell the whole world, which would have not made the amends right again, but stay silent about it. And it took about 6 months before I really fell in love with her and decided I did love her. And I'd see her from time to time. And she wouldn't look at me. She, you know, and I would just be pleasant. Not towards her, but I would just have pleasant countenance about me because I really got back feeling better and better. But it was about 6 months before I really felt like, hey, I do love her. And finally, about 6 months or a year later, you know, she finally opened up and talked a little bit. And then we just talked nice, very nice to each other. Almost on purpose, she would ask me, how are you? And, you know, almost on purpose. And so that thing came around. It didn't happen right away. Don't want you to think it did. The truth of the matter is, it was the right thing to do. I forgave myself also in that for letting myself get beat up for a whole month and not take care of business when I should have. And we all fall into that where we do something that is unpleasing to ourselves, God certainly to ourselves, and then we damage and hurt ourselves. So forgiveness of myself, listening to God and accepting her. So I didn't mean to go on all that, but yeah, if you do acceptance, the whole thing is I should have accepted her just as she was, but I let my mind listen to all these people that did. Plus the glory of Linda, you know, everybody thinks that my girlfriend said joking with me, said, why are they looking for, what's his name, Laden, Laden, whatever? All they have to do is send you to go get him. And of course, you know, I love that because I'm a God to God, I take care of all the problems. You know, people pleasing, codependent, blah, 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 blah. I'm grateful to be a member of Codependence Anonymous to straighten out.
Wow. Quite impressive. That was great. Hey. Does that, how about that with respect to accept? Sure. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. The steps. Work in the 12 steps, especially right. The fourth step. It taught me to love, I intertwine them, to love, accept, and forgive myself. And what that did was it allowed me to be accountable for my own behavior and have compassion, and the compassion overflows to other people. So when I get stuck, I have to connect to my higher power to gain that compassion.
That's good. That's
and great. Also to gain that unconditional love towards people. And so what really helps me is that there's an expression, hurt people hurt people.
Yeah.
So, and in my opinion, dishonesty is part, if somebody's dishonest, in my opinion, they're in their addiction. So I don't take it as personal anymore. So I have to connect to my higher power to gain that compassion.
Yeah.
And also to learn to create boundaries around all that.
And that's great.
That's what's been helping me. Because when I got to that fourth step to look at my behavior, now I have the compassion when other people are in that same mode.
That's great. That's beautiful. Thank you very. Thank you very much. Yes.
Would you share with us how your sponsor worked with you on this, and how you used your sponsor?
Well, I'm working on the fourth step again right now, and my sponsor and I met the other day, and he drove home that he wanted to get the first three real clear first. Because, you know, the idea of God and you know, that you're helpless, that you can't manage things on your own, that you, things have become unmanageable. And so that's where I am. And then we've gone through the first three, and now we're starting on the fourth. So I would expect that within the next 2 weeks, I will do a fifth step with him. And it's suggested by Melody, that you do the fourth and then step right into the fifth pretty fast, so that you, within a week, you get that completed. Maybe take an hour or two to get your word out. But the very fact that you have the courage, like it to me today, to stand up here and talk about my life with respect to all of the things, and I didn't get into all the things specifically, item by item, lady, woman by woman, or whatever, it's a stretch, because you know, so much of it is shame based and so on. But now at this moment, I feel fine. I feel great. I mean, and it's because I've let it, by the very expression of it, you're letting it go. It's taking some of the charge off. You're coming more and more to forgiveness. Coming more and more to loving yourself. Like what she pointed out, you pointed out that, hey, if you can keep forgiving, you're forgiving, you're opening up love all around you. And the more you can love the whole universe, and which I think everything is like God, we're all part of God, then you're getting closer and closer to the ultimate. And then your life gets easier and easier and easier. When you deal with somebody like Melody Beattie, my God, she went through extreme types of work to be able to get to the point of freedom from more and more. But what she does point out, that she got to a certain point where she just kind of got looked at what she had done wrong, or what was that she had, then she just turned it over to God to correct the defects of character, you know, and so it's really, it's beyond our hands. I mean, that's where the greatest control loss lies, is that all of a sudden you're turning it over to somebody who can really make you happy. Yes, you want to, yes.
I'll be interested to see how we're all working with this and feeling about this at the end of the day. You've given us a wonderful start. The other Melody, Pia Melody, talks about when she does this work for herself, she said sometimes the best she can do is gratitude, and she doesn't have to walk around 24 hours a day with that person's head on her shoulders.
Yeah.
let go of some stuff.
Yeah, right. You become a victim of them. You're constantly they're in charge of you.
Mm-hmm. But let them deal with that, their head, for the next 24/7.
Right.
And the one after that, and the one after that, and the one after that. Another important concept that I've gotten along the way is not only justice but mercy.
Right.
And there's a phrase, something like, God, treat me tomorrow as I am treating others today.
Yeah. That's the way it works. Whatever you put out, you're going to get back.
So,
I mean, it's infallible law of the universe. I mean, that's kind of the beauty of it.
Yeah. And as Julie was talking about, we talk about the vicious cycle. I like to think now more in the realm of the precious circle. If I have more compassion for you, perhaps I can have some more for me.
Right.
If I can have more compassion for me, I can have more for you. And
right.
That becomes a precious cycle,
right.
Rather than the vicious, precious circle rather than the vicious cycle.
Right, that's good. There's a book, Asking You Shall Be Given. And in it she says, Ethel Hicks and her husband, and she says, start off every day, 15 minutes meditation. And then every time during the day that you have a urge to complain, go into a rhapsody of appreciation. Rampage of appreciation. A rampage of appreciation. See what they're pointing out, that you can have more the more your vibrational level gets higher, because you're attracting to you, if you believe in that movie called The Secret or the book, you're attracting on the basis of your vibrational level. So if you don't get into the complaints and the downers and the negatives and keep coming back to appreciation, you're keeping yourself high and you're feeling better. And you're drawing more to you that keeps you more happy, winner, successful. Yes.
Getting back to the word acceptance, for me, my sponsor talked a year ago about acceptance. Accepting something doesn't mean I have to like it. And I would have never been able to figure that out, because I thought if I accepted it, I had approved of it.
Right.
This means for me to be forgiveness again. And
yeah. Right.
What is going on today in my life.
Right.
Because yesterday is gone. There's no getting enough. So that, you know, I've done my work, what I could have done in that day. Tomorrow isn't here yet, and I don't know what's going to happen.
Right.
But what's going on right now, the things are bothering me. I have to come to an acceptance of it, knowing that I am powerless over it, whether it be joy or, you know, sadness or anger or resentment. Coming to that place of accepting, knowing that this is exactly how it is right now, is when I've become peaceful.
That's great. That's beautiful.
I surrender my powerlessness over the situation, because no matter what happens in this world, God is there. You know,
God is what?
God is in it.
Yeah.
God is in the situation. And if I fully accept that, then I find peace and able to accept the situation no matter how it looks to me, because my perceptions of things are a lot of, my perception.
Yeah.
It might not even be what's really going on. You know, I don't see the good in everything all the time.
Right.
There's always good in everything.
Well, in that big book thing about acceptance, it points out that whatever is happening, that it's happening because nothing happens in this world, God's world, by mistake. Now, that's a huge one. It's sort of like, like that everything's kind of meant to happen in terms of there's a reason for everything that's taking place. You know, an interesting person also to deal with forgiveness and being happy is Eckhart Tolle with The Power of Now. Because to the degree I have found that I let my thoughts drop away or I if I can actually disengage. What he says is, and I believe it to be true, that to the degree you can disengage from your thoughts, because that's when you're like an ego in the past or the future, to the degree that you can witness your thoughts, that you actually have the capacity to witness your thoughts, to the degree that you can do that and come into the present, you are really in a holy spot. And then there's hardly anything to forgive, because like through acceptance and being right with the moment, you kind of handled everything as it occurs. How's my time, Bob?
Okay, we're just about 10:30.
Okay, all right. Anybody other questions or yes? The what?
Dare to forgive.
And what's the...
Daring to forgive.
Daring to forgive. Okay, yes.
And I just want to say, ask a lot of questions about if you forgive, you don't necessarily forget. And the other person isn't necessarily going to reciprocate. But it's all about yourself. And that it's all like not to forgive is like carrying around toxic waste. And it's